Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilik, and Sujit Mello, discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com. Well, welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 133, being recorded on the 29th of June, 2016, with special guest Todd Abel. I'm Sujit, and on Skype with me, I have Kale, Evan, and a new guest co-host, Ryan Volum. Ryan, welcome to the show, and we'll get the mic over to Todd in just a little bit, but as usual, we have some updates to talk about. Actually, let's just start with Ryan and Kale. You guys are in Montreal. What's going on over there?
We link out there. I put one in the linked up a couple weeks ago. We were doing an edX session, so we're partnering with the edX. So we're up here with some of the top partners in Canada, reviewing Azure architecture, going over studies from the courseware that we have out there for people to learn about how to build solutions on Azure.
Great. That's very nice. Looking forward to getting those put up there on edX. That's going to be published sometime soon?
Yeah, it's actually already out there. So we're sort of extending the edX course by doing a day session, gets into a bit more detail, and actually goes through the architecture problems that are posed in the edX in the context of these partners. And everyone has their own groups, and they build their own architectures.
All right. Cool. All right. So, we just have to put a few tips and tricks, and I think Kale's got some links as well, which we'll talk about. But let's start with... I don't know if you guys said FreeBSD is now available in the Azure Marketplace. I think this is probably a couple of weeks old, but we didn't talk about this. How big a deal is this? Evan, do you see a lot of folks using FreeBSD?
Yeah, I was talking to some of my colleagues about this the other day, and so total honesty and disclosure, I'm not aware of any of our direct plans in this direction. Linux is obviously much, much more important to us than it was in the past. To me personally, Evan's opinion, this looks like we're moving in the direction of having a distro that is Microsoft's distro, and I could see it potentially becoming something like a Red Hat over time. That's just kind of because this is a distro where we know the source. Right. We built it, and that means that we can actually debug the kernel. We can do all those kind of things that today we say the reason we do with Windows is because we know the code. Well, we know the code here too. I don't know exactly where this is going, but that just, I'd bet a little bit of money that we're going in that direction, and I think it makes sense.
Now, from what I remember, FreeBSD, I believe, is sort of the underlying operating system for OS X, right?
I'm not sure. I know it runs a bunch of appliances, virtual appliances that run on Linux. But I'm not
it's
sure
also supposed to be one of the most secure versions of Linux or Unix out there, and that's how I remember FreeBSD from the old days. So it's good that we're going to support it. Actually, we can. It says that, so that's good. Another couple of tips I want to run through, and then we'll jump to some of the updates that Kale has. This one is probably an oldie but a goodie. I'd forgotten about this, but apparently you can improve the performance of the portal if you've got a browser or a computer that's a little slow, and the portal tries to do all those fancy animations where the things swipe in and out. If you either find that too annoying or it's running a little too slow for you, apparently there's a setting. You can go into the portal settings and you can actually disable those animations, and that'll make it a little faster, a little quicker for you to navigate around. So I thought that was a cool one.
The one I was going to call out, Sujit, and I added this. It was kind of funny. Not like 2 hours after we talked about Azure Government last week with Aaron, right? We announced that we've got some additional FedRAMP certifications. And actually, I'll tell you about some of them. There's one called the Information Impact Level 4. Remember, you know, Aaron talked about impact stuff. Yeah. And then the International Traffic in Arms Regulations, ITAR, and then a FedRAMP High Formal. So, I mean, to our customers that are in that space, those terms probably are really important to them. But, you know, again, this was not 12 hours after we had gotten done talking
about it. Figures, right? But, yeah, that's a good timely update, though. At least we could follow it up this week.
Yeah.
Hey, Kale, you want to pick any from the list that you put out?
Yeah, I got a couple there. The first one being the Visual Studio 2015 Update 3 and .NET Core. I don't know. I know, Sajid, you're pretty connected with the core, the .NET Core. But that's released out there, so people should grab that and install it if you're using 2015.
And, yeah, I'll just say one thing. The reason why that's of special importance in the Azure world, of course, is because .NET Core is essentially a cloud optimized version of .NET, and if you're running on, and you could run it on, you know, on Unix, Windows, and OS X, so that's the other advantage of it. So definitely, this is an extremely important update in my mind to .NET. I know it says .NET Core 1.0, and yeah, we haven't gone back like from 4.6 to 1.0. It's just this is the core version of .NET. It's like a minimized version of .NET, and they're starting the versioning from 1.0. But this is something that I think everybody should get their hands on, including the Visual Studio Update 3, which has all the tooling support for it.
Yeah, and if we're going to talk about .NET Core, we got to mention that, you know, we RTM'd .NET for Linux this week as well. For you know, there was a ton of announcements around that as well.
That's right, yeah. And so, you know, I think that's one thing I haven't tried yet. I've tried running it on. I think I may have tried to run it on my Mac Mini, but I haven't tried it on the Linux Destroy yet. So I gotta check that out. What else you got in there? Let's see. DNS security appliances in Azure. What is that about?
Yeah, I think that's really around. There's some different offerings that we have out there for protection of DNS, which is something that maybe is overlooked before. And it kind of, there's a nice blog post out there that kind of walks through some of the surface area attacks there, like what can actually happen, and, you know, it starts from like how DNS actually works and kind of goes through like people might be susceptible to. So it's just kind of some guidance around that, as well as some of the offerings that we have in Azure around helping support that, secure that.
Okay. All right. That's good. The other one that you put out there, Kay, which I thought was pretty interesting, it's more guidance than anything else, but there's now some information on how you can achieve high availability and discovery and disaster recovery with your application. You know, as you're designing your app, if you've got something that absolutely must work no matter what the circumstances, even though it's in Azure, obviously, you know, Azure itself, you know, can be susceptible. Parts of Azure can be susceptible to some sort of natural disaster or some sort. So, what do you have to do to make your app more business to ensure business continuity in case of such disasters is what the guidance is put out, and we'll put up a link to that in the show notes.
Yeah, I think that one's really good. We just had a session on that today talking about high availability in DR, BCDR, and one of the things is, you know, making sure that people don't have like false sense of security kind of thing. Like, make sure you understand, you know, the consistency levels of like your applications and how they're writing the disks as in concert with all this DR technology and HA technology that's available. So I think this is kind of key to understand those features and what's available and what's covered and you know, where any gaps might be.
Yeah, and further than just understanding it, I'd say, you know, really actually test it. Take something down, break something, and make sure that it ultimately spins back up and ultimately ends up working.
Okay, that's good. That's good advice there. So yeah, we'll share that in the show notes. I want to just cover one more tip, and then we'll, which I think we should, you know, introduce our guests for the evening, but let me just, this one's a good one. So Azure Resource Manager, now there's, I guess, you know, if you need to lock certain changes that you made so that, you know, somebody else doesn't override them and things like that, apparently now you could do that in ARM. You could go and lock certain areas so that somebody else can go and change it. And I guess you have to go and unlock it first. So that's a new feature that's available in the portal. Okay. So without further ado, let's turn over to Todd Abel, our guest of honor for the evening. Todd, thank you very much for taking the time to come on the podcast. I would appreciate if you could just give our listeners a quick background on, you know, what you do at Microsoft and you know, however much you want to share about how you arrived at where you are today at Microsoft.
Okay, thank you. Nice to meet you guys. So my name is Todd Abel. I'm a program manager on the Service Fabric team, and I'll just give you a little bit of history around my Service Fabric experience. Service Fabric is a product that Microsoft GA'd about 2 months ago, I guess, but it's been an internal tool for Microsoft for a number of years, and many of our high-scale, large service offerings are actually built on top of Service Fabric, and I was the architect for two of those. Intune and part of Windows Defender. And so I really liked the technology, and it was time to change jobs again inside of Microsoft, and I decided I was going to go to the Service Fabric team because I liked the technology so much, and I wanted to spread that technology as far as possible because it's really interesting technology that really helps you if you need to build a distributed system. So that's sort of the background.
That's a great story, Todd. And we met at a customer site, and it was very much you know, an eye-opener for me, some of the information you gave us on Service Fabric. So, you know, we have talked about Service Fabric on this podcast before, maybe at least a couple of episodes, I think, because, you know, although it GA'd a couple of months ago, it was in preview for a long time before that, and we've talked about it on the show quite a bit. But, you know, one thing that has not been very clear to me, and I think I've heard that from our listeners and our some of my customers as well, is, you know, what are people using Service Fabric for? You know, like some, we'd like to understand some good use cases for Service Fabric. And when I say use case, I don't mean hypothetical use case. I mean, like, how are people actually using it? Because I think that'll open up a lot of discussion with our listeners when they understand how people have been leveraging it. And, of course, you know, assuming it has been working well for them, that will allow them to think about how they could use Service Fabric in their own organizations for their own workloads and use cases. So that's something that I was hoping to kind of explore with you today.
There's no general patterns it follows. If you have a need to build basically a distributed system, Service Fabric does a lot of the really hard work, like application lifecycle, and, you know, it solves about where I should be running nodes and things like this. Things that typically people do now either manually or they write scripts to be able to do these things. Service Fabric has a lot of that stuff built in. And so we really vary, like, it's the basis of DocumentDB, of SQLDB, of, like I mentioned, Intune. It shipped in an on-premise version in Link. Some of the early Link servers on-premise had Service Fabric inside of it. And it's used by customers in so many different scenarios, going from gaming to a lot of IoT scenarios, hopefully some banking. So it's really used in so many different situations. You can't really, I mean, some people are using it to build websites or backends for websites. So there's all sorts of different uses that people are using this technology for. You can't really say it's good for this, it's good for that. It's always good to talk about how you want to use it and then see if it actually solves your problem, because it does have a learning curve. And as with any distributed system, they're actually not that simple to build. There's lots of complexities to it, so it's always good to have something to help you out.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head there. Like, there's a lot of new concepts in Service Fabric, and we've talked about some of them on the show before. But I guess, like, when you say that it can be used for almost anything, yes, I mean, but is it always a good idea to use it to build almost anything? I guess that's what I'm trying to understand. You mentioned, like, a website, right? I mean, is it a good idea to put a website on Service Fabric? I mean, what do you get out of it by putting it on Service Fabric as opposed to, say, running it in, you know, as an app service or something in Azure, for example?
Yeah, if it's just a normal, simple website that doesn't have, you know, especially with, like, static pages, no, Service Fabric is overkill. I should be more specific. If you're building something that really requires a distributed system technology, so you're building a very complex website that has a bunch of back-end services where you need to coordinate across those, and you need to keep a whole bunch of either stateless or stateful services up and running, then Service Fabric can really help you out in those particular scenarios. But if you're doing something that is relatively lower scale or doesn't have very high throughput requirements or anything like that, it might be okay to not use Service Fabric, right? But in the high throughput cases where you need to be up all the time, Service Fabric provides a lot of functionality to help keep that service up. Like, if a service crashes, it'll bring a new one up in, you know, milliseconds. It doesn't actually take that long to detect that failure and bring a new copy of that up. Most times, if the customer does a retry or your infrastructure does a retry, they won't even notice that that instance went down because it's being serviced by the new instance that's there. But as you say, it's not for every single case. It is for the complex cases.
Okay, so I was wondering if you could maybe pick one that you particularly felt proud about, or, you know, maybe we can just talk about it at high level as to how they leveraged, what are the various pieces that they had to use to put it together, just to give us a flavor as to, you know, how one would approach a typical Service Fabric implementation.
Sure, I can actually talk a little bit about Intune. So I joined the Intune team when it was version 1.0, and the very first version of Intune was actually built on top of SQL Server. The problem with that is, of course, SQL was our bottleneck, right? And we had the vision to serve millions and millions and millions of devices with Intune. And how are we going to do that? We couldn't figure out a way with the way the existing code was written inside of SQL to actually move it forward. That's when Service Fabric came in as the solution for us that allowed us to actually change the way we thought about it and actually built, instead of the more monolithic application like we had, to move to a more distributed system where we ended up building scale units, and they had a very large number of microservices in them now. The Intune team has a fairly substantial number of microservices that all communicate with each other, and they've been able to actually add services over time without changing any of the core services or without breaking the service or having to do major deployments or anything like that. So, you know, it's the whole change to the way to build microservices and distributed systems that Service Fabric helped out with. Does that explain it?
Yeah, enough? No, that's definitely one of the good use cases. And so you had a lot of stuff that was based out of SQL Server, right? You were doing a lot of processing in SQL Server, and maybe you had web services around it in the past. And now we're doing that all with Service Fabric. What do you do with all that? I mean, obviously there's like a elaborate model that you had in SQL Server. How did you solve that? How did you move that model into the Service Fabric world, for example, the data model?
Well, you have to think differently about it because, you know, in SQL you have the ability to do joins and all these nice primitives that SQL gives you. And when you move into a more distributed world where, I mean, the big thing we had to do to make it so SQL wasn't our bottleneck, or the data store wasn't our bottleneck, is we had to be able to partition that data store across many, many, many nodes. And the minute you do that, joins get hard, queries get hard, all sorts of things get hard. So you really had to think about how you're going to access the data and what was the fast path for access you needed. Are you read heavy or write heavy? And really how you're going to go access that data. And you designed your data model or your services, and your data model, of course, is part represented by all the set of your services, with how you were going to end up accessing it, either read or write, to make that really, really efficient. And we went back and forth. It took us a long time to come up with the right design, but I've been off the team for a little while, but as far as I know, the original services that we designed are still the same ones that are in production today, and they've worked across many, many scale units and many millions of devices that Intune actually handles. So I think we proved that the microservices and building it in a particular way works, but you do have to change the way the team thinks about things.
Right.
Hey, Todd, I did have one question that I hear sometimes about the Service Fabric, and one of the questions I hear is, you know, the fundamental thing here is that we have these nodes that are kind of decoupled, and we're just basically worried about our application, so we're focused on our bringing our application there and packaging it and running it on this fabric. But the underlying nodes, is there ways to control, like, how we scale those things up? Obviously, we can scale out and add more nodes in there, but what about, like, scaling the CPU or the compute power up there?
Yeah, so today, when you go and allocate a cluster in Azure, there's a node type 0, which is the primary node type. That one is where Service Fabric ends up running its services, so you can't scale that node type up. Because you would end up taking, without downtime, because you would end up taking Service Fabric services down. And they're the ones that run the rest of the cluster. But all of the other node types, which in the portal you can have 3 node types by default, but if you were to deploy using an ARM template, you can have up to 100 different node types in your cluster. So you can go in and let's say you have node type 0 is like a D4, and you have node type 1, which you have as D4s also today, and you've decided that you've allocated as many D4s as you want, and you want to scale to the next one up, you can go add a new node type of, let's say, a D14, add those nodes to the cluster, and then start taking away that node type 1, the D4s, basically one at a time, let the node and Service Fabric will move all the services around as you're removing nodes, it'll move them to the new machines and use that capacity. And if you just do it slowly, very thoughtfully, basically one at a time, you remove the nodes until you end up having that node type 0 of the D4s and the node type now 2 of D14s. And that's how you can end up doing scale up in addition to scale out.
So, you know, kind of along those same lines, you know, and maybe I'm just missing something here, but, you know, if the whole concept of Service Fabric at some level is scale out, right, for redundancy and distributed, when would you look at scaling up? I mean, wouldn't you just want to break if your service is using too many resources, wouldn't you just want to break it into a smaller chunk and then distribute that?
Sometimes, yeah, that's a fine choice. But sometimes you want either more CPU, or you want maybe your application is adding something and you need, it's going to be extremely CPU bound, and a high CPU machine or a high memory machine would be much more efficient. You got to remember from a cost perspective too, right? Having a whole bunch of small nodes isn't necessarily going to give you the same compute and memory that you have.
Yeah.
Right. So it might be cheaper for you to move to a larger machine, and you end up paying Microsoft less, but you end up getting more done. It's very application specific, and you really need to. I have a slide deck that I talk to customers about capacity planning, and like on Intune, I did a lot of the early capacity planning, and it literally took me. I wasn't concentrating on just the capacity planning, but it took me months to actually put the spreadsheet together, to think about it, to test configurations and make sure that we were doing things right, to build a really good capacity planning spreadsheet and know what your application is going to do, is a very intense exercise, but it's very necessary. Someone actually needs to do that. It's a very important part of the design. And when you are doing a capacity plan like that, make sure you're being as conservative as possible. The really good thing is about when I did that on Intune, every time we took it into the performance lab to test whether the code we ended up writing matched the capacity plan, every single time it performed better than the capacity plan, which is an awesome place to be. You don't want to be the other way around.
Right, right. Well, so it sounds like really then and this almost says, because you know, at least in my experience, very few people are able to accurately predict, you know, what their application is going to use resource-wise. I mean, they may have a sense of whether it's going to be CPU-bound or memory-bound, but how much CPU or how much memory, it's not going to know. So it sounds like really the approach with Service Fabric might be to kind of build it, you scale out, and then as you find that you just can't, you know, you're not getting enough CPU for the, you know, with the code you're running and the distribution that you have, that's when you would scale up versus starting big, potentially. Is that...
That's a fine way to go, okay. except for those primary nodes, because you can't resize
right.
them today.
Right.
If we fix that problem, and we want to fix that problem, then that won't be a problem. But on those nodes, I would actually start, if you think you're going to end up in D14s in the long term because you have a very large application or a set of services that you're going to run, you might want to start with some machines in that primary node type
right.
that are large and wait till you fill them up until you add the next node type.
Gotcha. Okay. No, that makes sense.
Yeah, and in the case where you might be deploying a new service that could be, say, very GPU intensive, you know, we've now got these new GPU VMs that are coming out. You might specifically, you know, choose that you want to scale up to those because that VM specifically fits the use case here.
That's right.
Yep.
Yeah, it's just a challenge. I mean, Azure brings a lot of flexibility to that, right? Because you can scale up and scale down without yeah. having to rebuild your server, you know, versus on-premises, once you bought it, you own it. But I find customers regularly struggle with...
Yeah, definitely.
How do they yeah. decide what to do? And then I also find they forget that they can scale down as well as scale up.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's probably a good thing to mention at this point that you know, Azure Service Fabric runs both on premises and in Azure itself, so customers have that choice over here. But you know, Todd, I wanted to just dig into that use case that you brought up, which is, okay, you've got your stuff, you had your stuff in a database, and now you're moving that model into Service Fabric somehow. You know, I think we probably talked about it when you were over at my customer, but there's a couple of ways you could do that, right? You could say, like in the Intune case, one way to go, which might be extreme, is, you know, every device is represented by a reliable actor, for example, right? Because that's a self-contained unit. Or you could have a reliable service and then use the collections, the reliable collections to host all the data. So, I mean, is that the kind of thinking that you have to go through? What do you do with? I'm trying to figure out, like, how do you migrate that data model over to Service Fabric?
Yeah, you do have to go through that thinking, and you have to have these two programming models that you have to figure out which one is the best one for me. And we do have a little bit of guidance on that. Actors are good in IoT type scenarios where you're going to have many, many, many actors, but they're basically infrequently activated, and you never want to build, like, you can build a tree of actors where you activate an actor and it might activate some other ones underneath that. But you don't want to build a graph of
right.
actors,
right.
because of the way that the calling pattern works, you can't really come back in and call an actor. I mean, we do some of that, but it can break down fairly quickly. So you have to be careful about building a graph of actors. So there's those type of trade-offs, but they are good for IoT type scenarios. And we have a number of customers that are successfully using actors in an IoT type scenario. We even have an internal team that does a lot of the monitoring for most of the Microsoft services. They're using actors. They built basically a MapReduce style implementation with actors, where the actors go out and they pull data in, they calculate it and report it back to another actor that coalesces it and responds to the request and sends the data back to lots of internal Microsoft people. So it's actually a pretty cool use case for that. The collections are also, that's what we ended up doing with Intune, basically the equivalent of collections. And you just really have to think, there's all sorts of different variables that go into how you build that data model. And the very natural thing to do that you have to fight is, it's very natural for everyone to think about it as a table, right? And you're going to have a table, and you're going to have this relationship, other one that's a relationship, and you end up building a relational model, but without all the relational capabilities. So it gets really, really hard. So you have to really fight that. And anytime you see yourself talking about relations or tables or things like that, you should really question what you're doing and if that's the right way, if you're on the right track. A lot of the discussions we had were how coarse should the object be? Like, should I have a service that models small fragments of a device that we're managing, or do I have a service that models the entire device and we just go in and get it? And there's trade-offs there, right? Mm. And the thing that I've found, I have a slide on this too in the deck, that it's I call it the Goldilocks problem, because in some cases you're going to be too coarse, in some cases you're going to be too fine-grained. But the telltale tale that tells you, or the sign that tells you that you're either too fine or too coarse, in my opinion at least, is whether you start replicating the data from these services into others, because either it's taking too long to get it out, or you've got to query too many services to be able to build up the entity that you actually want to return to your customers. Mm-hmm. So if you find that you're replicating data across these services to make it more efficient, you probably have the wrong granularity for your entities.
So to make sure I understand that, so basically you're saying if I'm trying to build, you know, I don't know, some you know, set of properties or some object kind of conceptually, if I have to have the same data in multiple services, that says I've probably gone too fine-grained, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Or too coarse-grained, right? So the opposite side is you put all your data in one, but now I end up replicating part of that over to another service because it's too inefficient to go query that and bring back all of this huge object back. And then I'm only going to use a few fields, so I'm just going to replicate those over. I've heard both excuses right. from developers, and those are signs that you really have the wrong granularity for your objects.
So just to make sure I understand, because this is a really neat concept, is, and again, this is similar to the, you know, when you're writing good code in general, right? If I have to carry around all these globals all the time, but I'm only using a portion of the global, that's probably not scoped right. This sounds very similar, where, you know, I'm at the right granularity when I can kind of have this one thought or this one construct that I don't have to get it. I don't have to talk to anybody else to manipulate it, but nobody else has to have a copy of it either, or
that's
a copy
right.
of a piece of it.
That's right. I mean, I think that's one of the tenets of microservices, right? Is that I own this data that I manage,
right.
and if anybody wants that data inside the application that we're building, they call me to get the data. Right, and if you just end up taking that out and replicating it to other places, which is a really natural thing for developers to do, you're probably doing it wrong, because now when you actually go change that microservice and you add new data, you've got to go change a whole bunch of other services, and
right.
you may not know about that, right? And you're right back into the monolithic application that we're all trying to get out of.
Okay. No, that makes sense.
Very good. Yeah, that was well put there. Thanks. Okay, I think that's very useful information, Todd. You guys, have any more thoughts?
I had one question, Todd. Maybe for our listeners, when they're getting started with this, is there different vectors, or is this something where they should just be leveraging something like Visual Studio to do this, or are there other toolings that are being built, or is there other ways to kind of deploy out to the fabric without using something like Visual Studio?
So when you're doing development, Visual Studio is a great tool to use. If for a production environment, Visual Studio is probably not the right way to do that. You would want to have either use a CI/CD type solution that you have. Most of our stuff can, or all the Service Fabric stuff can do deployment via PowerShell scripts. So you can tailor that into whatever production deployment system you actually have. And that's usually the best way to do it for a production deployment. For test clusters or your dev box, Visual Studio is great.
Awesome. That's great.
Okay. Excellent. Thanks. Thank you, Todd, for that deep dive, so to speak, into the Service Fabric. And I'm sure our listeners will find that very, very useful and very educational. Ryan, good to have you, and thanks for all your comments. All right, then we'll talk to you guys next week. Thank you.
Okay, yeah,
great. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Todd.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle,
at Azure Podcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.